You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest is assistant professor at NYU Environmental Studies, and she goes by the name of Jennifer Jacquet. Not Jacquet, but Jacquet. I would say Jacquet, because it just sounds more French.
Because Jennifer, you've taken Michelle Thomas French.
Yeah. Jennifer, we're going to get in your book called Is Shame Necessary? New Uses for an Old Tool. I loved it. I know Hunter did, and Hunter's the one that said, you got to read this book. We're going to get into your brain. I do have to say, you belong kind of in front of a camera. You kind of belong on the cover of a magazine. Usually when you think of professors, you think of, I don't know, somebody who's got gray hair and they've got the posture of a jumbo shrimp, and you're the exact opposite of that. So, but you didn't want to Skype with us. And
I'm a tiny elephant, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying you're a beautiful woman. I think that's that's what I'm trying to get at. You've got brand, you know, when you write a book this good, and I can't wait to get into it, you figure, you know, anyway, you're the whole package, Jennifer. That's what I'm trying to say. All right, so congratulations on your bone structure and on your book, which obviously took a lot of thought. So let's get into that.
One of them took a lot more effort.
I love it. All right, well, so is shame necessary? I thought it was really an interesting take, and I've thought a lot about this. I've always said, if you want a company to change, you got to hit them where they live, which is in their pocketbook, and consumers have to take the reins and figure out a way to get them to pay a price for their bad behavior. And you use a lot of examples for that. But what got you to? You're a professor of environmental studies and things, and you dove with sharks, and you've done all that. You've always been involved in the environmental movement. But what got you to write this book? Was it just trying to figure out a way to get corporations to practice proper stewardship? What?
Yeah, exactly. I was really tired of sort of being saddled, burdened psychologically, and then also, I think, in a real sort of actionable way with environmental problems. I felt like I was being asked to feel bad and do things like turn off the lights or drive less or take fewer flights. And that made some sense, but it wasn't the kind of change that could really scale. And so I make the argument in the book that those techniques, which are facilitated using guilt to a large degree, had eclipsed the tool of using shame to go after large corporations or even governments and getting them to change their ways, and therefore making these big changes at large scales.
And I think one of the examples that I really loved is, you know, you made the point that if we all gave up as consumers electricity, it would have the same effect on carbon footprint as if Chevron reduced their consumption by 10%.
Yeah, if we all chose to live in the dark.
Well, I love the other example where if they told you to unplug your cell phone charger, and if all of us did that, it would be equivalent of driving 1 second less. So their information is so important, and there's a lot of misinformation out there, but knowing the kinds of actions that really make a difference, that's the other thing you touch on in the book.
Yeah, exactly. So those are kind of two separate things, right? There's the what can I actually do as an individual to make a difference? And then there's also what does my individual behavior matter in the face of, you know, Chevron or Exxon or any of these big companies?
And the point is that the individual contribution that I actually have to make is basically nothing. I'm mostly powerless to do anything about the environment.
Well, unless you're someone like Bill Gates, right?
Oh, I am.
Mean, certain individuals have a lot of power.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, for me at least, as a, you know, assistant professor, I have very little I can do relative to, you know, the super powerful mega transnational corporations.
Well, you talk about the limits of shame. You know, your example of how we went from using nets to catch tuna to long lining and Bumblebee and Starkist and I think Heinz owns Bumblebee or something. One of them. But the big corporations were shamed into behaving differently. That's an example of not only a success story, but also some shortcomings, which you talk about with the Marine Stewardship Council and how people can actually misuse that label and things. But was tuna fishing, the change in tuna fishing, was that a success story?
Yeah, so that is with regards to dolphin-safe tuna. And yeah. So the question was, how do we go about changing that? Do we get consumers to stop buying dolphin-unsafe tuna, or do we make blanket regulations that affect the entire industry? And the argument is that basically whenever you have these little labels like organic foods or fair trade, these are representing across the board no more than 10% of the marketplace. So as much as you can say, oh, we really want consumers to solve things, when you actually look at what's going on, it's no more than 10% of the market actually changing. So my point with this example was to say, yes, things did change a little bit. Dolphins do have a little bit of a safer life now with the tuna fishing boats, but that was largely as a result of regulation rather than a totally market-based approach.
This is new. This is new information to me. You know, I've always, Pronter always makes fun of me because I'm always like, well, the marketplace, let it decide. But it was new information for me in that sense that you do need enforcement. You do need regulation. I'll tell you this much. I hunt. I'm not a hunter, but I do a TV show every year called Meat Eater. And I hunt with this guy, Steve Rinella, who knows everything about animal behavior. And it's a wild show. I've learned more, though, about the importance of regulation. If you didn't have strict regulation on hunters, I don't think a lot of hunters would disagree with this. You would have wholesale slaughter out there. You just have guys drunk with machine guns doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So you.
But isn't it true that in Michigan, even the legally blind can still hunt?
I don't know about that, but listen, I'm an
but
equal
have you
opportunity
not seen
employer.
Daredevil, so. Like just because a person is blind, like Daredevil proves
sense,
they can do some next level shit.
Yeah, sense.
Okay,
sense,
true.
Sense where the deer is. No, but so your point is that we can't rely just on shaming corporations. We can't rely just on consumer behavior. You do have to have some form of enforcement, coercion, some form of regulation. Is that what you're saying? That's the argument.
Well, I mean, I think that ultimately is the goal. But let's think about international climate change or there are problems that are so big and seemingly intractable where there is probably no prospect of regulation. And then again, we have to turn back to those more informal tools like shaming and reputation, because at that level, the real question is, what else do we have?
Well, but that's, I mean, you know, then you get into the question. We recently, actually the last person we interviewed was the former UN High Commissioner for Refugees. And he was talking about.
We also
had
Naomi Oreskes on this, which you cite in your book.
Yeah, wow, cool.
Yeah. We don't play around here. Keep going.
But, I mean, part of the point that he was making is just, you know, there are real consequences to a lack of an effective international sovereignty. And clearly something like global warming is one of those examples. But the question is, yeah, do we turn back to shame to deal with that crisis of sovereignty, or do we accept, hey, we have a real problem with not having an effective international body, and that's something we have to push for, something that
but
can
I don't,
regulate
But I think Jennifer's
things.
Saying that's not realistic, and the only thing we have is shame at this point for global warming.
Well, certainly
you wrote
at this
a book,
point,
I mean,
but
yeah.
Certainly at this point, but I think that's the thing. I mean, you know, as society becomes more complex and we really become a planetary civilization, we may need to realize that actually we do need some sort of effective international body. Otherwise, we're going to continue to see issues like in terms of what Jean-Pierre Oke was talking about, Syria, right, where we all know that this is a problem. We all know that something needs to be done, but nobody can step in to create effective peacekeeping because there's no international sovereign body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't disagree with that, merely just to say that shaming is a stopgap before that system's actually in place. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's interesting is that culture or institutions are actually behind biology in this case. Biology and chemistry, global ozone, for instance, that has shown us that we are all in it together, right? Whatever we throw into the atmosphere, people in Africa will be experiencing the effects. Mm. And yet we don't actually have the institutions and governing bodies to actually control for that or have every voice represented in that system.
My feeling is that trying to get any kind of international body is going to be about as effective as the United Nations. I don't care what anybody
says.
And I think there's got to be a different way. And I think the way to do that is to tap into the collective conscience, to say, listen, everybody has to do their part. You make a really interesting point about the Kyoto Protocol, which is that the United States forgot that, you know, when Bush said this isn't fair, everybody has to pull their own weight. Well, you know, you make a good point, which is that we also create 80% of, you know, a lot of the emissions in some cases, or 50% or whatever. So when you are contributing that much, spewing that much carbon into the atmosphere, you have a bigger responsibility as a superpower like the United States. I don't know. I'm very cynical at the idea that you could come up with some sort of global governing council.
And that
I don't
cynicism,
think it'll ever happen.
But that cynicism is really convenient. Essentially, you're being a merchant of doubt, Brian.
I don't believe it's the best way to do it, though.
No, because you're dissipating responsibility. Listen, when you've got a thousand years ago, when you've got people running around, they only have a limited ability to pollute. All they can do is chop down trees, right? That's one thing. But when you have a society as complex and as planetary as ours, where we have the ability to do real damage, then you have no choice. As Jennifer is saying, the biology is, I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but the point is that, you know, we are now at a place where we can do real damage, really affect people around the world, and our cultural institutions are lagging behind that. And I don't think that we're going to, for very long, have the luxury of saying, oh, I don't see that as being realistic and happening. Yes, it wasn't realistic in 1945.
My argument's actually different, Jennifer. I don't think that, you know, a centralized power is as effective as sort of divestment. What is the word? It's not as effective as sort of figuring out a way to diversify that sort of authority somehow. I mean, when you have a governing council, which is never going to happen, I'm sorry, but let's just say it does, I don't know that that's the most effective way to cool the planet.
Jennifer, I mean, isn't part of the point that there are certain things where the market is effective, and we can't just sort of assume, because you're still arguing for a market-based solution. You're essentially letting everybody compete and let everybody have different points of view and then let the best thing win.
I don't think we have a choice.
Yeah, that's really cheap.
Well, let's be clear, too, is that what we have right now is not a market-based solution. It's a highly subsidized system in which taxpayers are bearing a lot of the burden for, let's say, oil exploration, fossil fuel extraction, et cetera. So it really isn't. If the market did work effectively, if in the best case scenario, the market probably would do a better job than whatever we have now, which is actually states complicit with multinationals to exploit fossil fuels.
That's a really good point. With wind energy, the wind energy's argument is that fossil fuels are some of the most highly subsidized energy sources we have, and now they're talking about, you know, pulling back on subsidies for wind energy. And I think you're right. And I always forget how subsidized the fossil fuel industry is, Jennifer.
Well, not only is it subsidized on the front end, but it's also subsidized on the tail end because it is a harmful pollutant, and it's not being, the externalities, they like to call it in academia, but those harmful effects that they have, greenhouse gas emissions, are not being accounted for in the equation either. So I think that there's a lot of ways to talk about this, but there's no way to deny that the U.S. and China are two groups of people, countries that emit way more than anyone else. So as much as you want to say, well, I'd like to have sort of states power, or we're not likely to have an international governance system, all eyes really should be on these two countries to really start cooperating with the rest of the world. And that's where informal sanctioning, even on behalf of the UN, on behalf of the Pope, really does matter.
Really? Huh. Okay.
Yeah, because you're policing behavior. And isn't that, I mean, I think what's so great about your book as well is that you're looking, you know, shame is a part of who we are and it exists for a reason. And so, you know, let's just talk a little bit about what is the function of shame. Why do we have shame?
Yeah, well, so there are two different ways to conceive of shame. One is, of course, as the emotion, which we've all been familiar with. We know the feeling of sort of wanting to hide. And, Jonathan Franzen talks about the feeling of wanting to take a shower when he wrote Autobiographical Sentences.
I love that. You opened the chapter with that awesome quote. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have this intimate personal experience of shame. Then we also have the more feeling of shame as a result of the threat of exposure, which we see increases cortisol level, a stress hormone. It leads us to show displays of shame, like lowering our eyes or even blushing, which is one
among,
of the most...
Even among four-year-olds, I was fascinated with that case study that you highlight.
Exactly. And four-year-olds are a good test case because they haven't really learned to sort of lie with their signals yet.
Yeah.
So they lower their eyes and they show these increase in stress hormones. And then there's the case of shame that I'm most interested in, which is, I don't know necessarily how you feel. I'm not measuring your cortisol. I don't even know that you have a conscience, like in the case of Exxon or Chevron. But I know that somehow you change your behavior due to the threat of exposure. And that's what I'm most interested in, is shame as a tool, as a verb. And that's one area where our society, especially U.S. society, we've gotten really uncomfortable with that idea. Of course, Monica Lewinsky giving that TED talk earlier this year entirely against shame. But I think that it is a tool, and it can be used in really appropriate and ways that even the masses vastly support.
And isn't part of the reason why the U.S. in particular is so uncomfortable with shame is because we tend towards individualism, and we don't like the idea that the community should say what we can and can't do.
Yeah, that's part of my argument exactly, is that it somehow undermines our individualistic thinking. Like, why would I do something that just because the group wanted me to? But in some ways, and this is where I think we were talking a little bit over email, where I think the use of shame obviously can be terrible in the case of education or learning, but can be very good for things like behavior, social dilemmas, picking up after your dog, being quiet during class. That's the kind of area in which I think shaming, the threat of exposure, the threat of being called out, really works better, is when your bad behavior actually infringes on someone else's ability to learn.
Well, I thought it was really fascinating when you do the study in Indonesia. They asked 75 Indonesians and I think